You're listening to Sound Poetry. I am your host, David Gilmore. You're listening to Sound Poetry, Radio Tacoma, KTAH, 101.9 FM. And I'm your host, David Gilmore. I'd like to welcome Susan Rich from Seattle, a poet that has been in many exotic places in the world, some of which you'll see in the poems themselves with the nomenclature that tells you where and sometimes what, but definitely on the go. So we go on to another one from Vitesse, Bosnia-Herzegovina. Herzegovina is not a place that many people probably go to for touring, but travel, it would be a travel, I would say, to go there. Explain a little about Ghazal. We have had poems that are named Ghazal. It can take on many different forms as couplets. How did you choose the Ghazal idea?
I think the Ghazal appeals to me because it's trying to be nonlinear. You are supposed to be able to take each couplet separately and have it have a meaning and have it have a place in the world. And originally, they were not written down, but were oral tradition. I think, trying to remember if it was Iran, Turkey, these are some of the areas Hafiz would do ghazals. And you would sign it. You would put your signature hidden in the end of it. So this poem, I don't remember exactly why, except that I think I worked in Bosnia-Herzegovina twice after the Yugoslavian war, after the Serbs invaded Bosnia-Herzegovina and Croatia. And so it was a time of trying to figure out a very complex war map. I was in the middle of it, and I think I got a better understanding of it, but I remember reading about the war, being here, and really not understanding it. And I can still remember a news story that said that just like us, Bosnians would be watching the war on their televisions and driving their Toyotas. And I thought, how can a culture that has televisions and Toyotas be at war? Like at that point, I was naive and innocent enough to not understand. So to answer your question, I think it was the idea of the fragmentation and working with that and allowing for these different moments. And of course, it really does become one moment, one experience that I did have that becomes the poem. But I was, so it's interesting, you try for fragments and you get straight narrative. Ghazal for the woman from Vitesse, Bosnia-Herzegovina. It's the best watermelon in the world, but there's no way to say it in words. She had squatted in the space for apples and pears under the staircase 1 year beyond the place of words. Now she comes back with tea, examines me closely, my out-of-date phrase book, my mispronounced words. I ask for the toilet, and she shows me the bedrooms, bombed by neighbors who should have known how to use words. We walk out to her garden in late afternoon light, survey squash plants and corn stalks. We re-enter words. In Bosnian, the tomato is called paradise, sweetness transferred from some other country's words. We drink rounds of whiskey, call her sons on the phone, laughing because we have found a way out through words.
Yes, each one can be taken as a snapshot that you can think on after each couplet. But as you say, you've bound it together with the ending of words, in words, of words, and so on. And there is perhaps a connectedness that you can't help but make out as you read through it. And weren't gazelles also sung?
Sung, and also in the originally they were rhymed and rhymed, but that kind of is a bit, I don't know if I've seen it in English done particularly well to have a repetition of a word and to have the rhyme at the same time. And if I was being a purist about it, in the first couplet, I would have had to use words. It's the best watermelon in the words, which doesn't really make sense. So I broke the form.
In the world, yes. I think it works very well for an unusual place that has a complex of culture. I mean, the Orientalism that's there with the Muslim population, after all, and the Turk and the Persian and so on, from which where we read gazelles too in those classical forms. Yes, so it is a very good choice for that. So it brings that together too.
Thank you.
So we're still going to go on with the works that we have. Let's see, what is the next one that you chose? I've got my markers in the book.
Muhammad at the Mosque.
Oh, that's right. Muhammad at the Mosque. Okay. Yes.
And this is, as it says, for my student upon his graduation. Muhammad at the Mosque. And sometime later, in the lingering blaze of summer, in the first days after September 11th, you phoned. If I don't tell anyone my name, I'll pass for an African-American. And suddenly, this seemed a sensible solution, the best protection, to be a Black man born in America, more invisible than Somali, Muslim, asylum seeker. Others stayed away that first Friday, but your uncle insisted that you pray. How fortunes change so swiftly, I hear you say. And as you parallel park across from the Tukwila Mosque, a young woman cries out, her fears unfurling beside your battered car. Go back where you came from. You stand, both of you, dazzling there in the midday light. Her pavement facing off along your parking strip. You tell me she's only trying to protect her lawn, her trees, her untended heart, already alarmed by its directive. And when the neighborhood policeman appears, asks you, asks her, asks all the others, so what seems to be the problem? He actually expects an answer, as if any of us could name it, as if perhaps your prayers chanted as this cop stands guard, watching over your windshield during the entire service, might hold back the world we did not want to know.
Yes, the writhing of changes in the world, and we never know what change can come so quickly. This hostility that comes out of an incident that's probably far away, but still resonates all over the world, perhaps, not just in America, but elsewhere too. Your student had to do some quick thinking. I mean, imagine having to change your attitudes, your thoughts. How am I going to present myself now? What should I say in greeting people and making myself known? Trouble, a problem, especially in America. We're moving through the Muslim world in those two poems, because we are we do have the feeling of that very strongly in the poem you've read, and of hostilities. But the world that we did not want to know.
Well, I think a lot of things seemed to change after September 11th, or maybe they just became things that we couldn't ignore in the same way. I had a lot of, and still do, but particularly at that moment at Highline, a lot of Muslim students. And so it felt like a dangerous time. And yet I think about that cop guarding my student's car while he goes into mosque to pray. And what I always feel like I tried so hard to get into that poem and couldn't find a graceful way was that my student's car was like banged up and dented. And he had a friend who I think was from somewhere in Asia who had just gifted it to him when the other student went home saying, here, you can have it. You couldn't open it on one side. The handle was gone. The windshield was cracked. And so the idea of the cop protecting this particular car is a whole other level of irony that just didn't fit in the poem.
That's right. That would have been a very interesting symbolism in that poem, wouldn't it?
Yeah, next time.
Interpretation of that. Yeah.
Couldn't get it to work.
Well, this next one, which is Hunger is Best Cooked. You probably want to mention something about the origin of that one, because it's it comes out of photography and a particularly interesting person that many would not know. Would you like to?
I'd be thrilled, yes. And also how I got, this was really the first poem that I wrote that I knew I was doing this thing called ekphrastic work. And all that means is taking inspiration from visual art. Traditionally, poetry and painting were thought of as sister arts. And when I first looked at this photograph, I really understood it to be a painting. And in fact, that was the idea. The photographers were trying to be painterly.
Painterly. Mm-hmm.
And so this really does look like a Dutch, still a Dutch painting. I was in the Frye Art Museum in Seattle. I was waiting for a friend to get off work. And while I was waiting for him, I was just roaming around the wonderful museum. And this piece, this photograph, just, it stopped me. And I immediately took out a notebook and jotted down just a couple of lines and went on with my evening. That was kind of the end of it. For about 3 years, when I found myself on sabbatical and was looking for writing. And so I went back to the museum expecting to find this piece because I liked my 3 or 4 lines that I had written, which doesn't happen all that often, and found that it had not been a painting, but a photograph. It had been part of a traveling show. And I had an incredibly, I wish I could thank this woman now, the woman who worked in the gift shop, kind of came out with me. I pointed to exactly where I expected the piece to be. And she said, oh, that was part of Photographers of the Northwest. And she went in and she found me a catalog that I could get that had information about Myra Albert Wiggins and 3 other women from the Northwest who were also photographers. And this is really early in photography. Photography's been around, I'm bad with dates, but probably about 25 years. But it was really marketed as something for women to do in the home with their children, which is kind of funny. So that might be more than what you were asking for, but I really had an aesthetic experience with this piece. And it led me into this whole world that I'm still working on decades later of looking at women artists. So Hunger is the Best Cook, after a photograph by Myra Albert Wiggins, 1898. And let me also say, this was a very common phrase at the time. Hunger is the best cook. You can probably think about what it might mean. If you're really hungry, anything is going to taste great. And so this was an advertising phrase, just a common proverb that people would use.
Yes.
Dark bowl, small mouth, sumptuous spoon. Whatever there is, there's not much here. But the girl's intent, enraptured nearly, in the pause and trick of it, the mythic mirror of abeyance. Her body opens toward the rim of awe, all lick and swallow, imagination readying the tongue. Is art simply a hymn to reconfiguration? Wild huckleberries, wedge of bread, broken chaff from the season's ripe wheat. The museum patron presumes the sharp taste, believes fully in the meal, where the spoon doesn't waver, where the girl will never bring this moment to its end and eat. But this is not the story of the actual moon-faced, well-fed photographer's daughter, reclothed and then again for a mother's ambitious narrative. The costume, the curtains, the fable rise in what the woman called the Vermeer style, deficiency reshaped for pleasure's sake. Fistfuls of wildflowers rupture the room as she shoots frame after frame, cajoling the unstudied studio pose. Is her family shrapnel or daisy chain? Wiggins' curved hand charting the shutter, half right, half wrong, lighting through to the alchemist's kitchen.
Yes, ekphrastic poetry, but and a person can go to the Myra Albert Wiggins site, and where there are many images, one of which is the child. So if you wish, listeners, to have the image of the picture of the young girl, you can find that and see just what Susan has done to, write a hymn to reconfiguration. There's a transformation, alchemistic, as you use the word, I think, for the first time in some of these poems, the alchemist's kitchen, that there is an alchemy to ekphrastic writing, because it's what your eye sees, is what you and how you interpret it. But as you say, it's very difficult to do that effectively, just as it is for a photographer to compose and make what is very artificial seem real, or a moment that is so preciously in the moment at this second of touching the snapper to get that image, to capture that image. And it is a wonderful picture. I mean, as you say, the imagination readying the tongue, it's there in the child's profile. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, you've captured it. You've captured it really well. I enjoyed reading this over and looking carefully at that Vermeer-like photograph that Wiggins had composed. Very, very good.
She tricked me, right? She totally tricked me that when I first looked at it, I was sure it was
a painting.
And then when I thought it was her child and she's wearing a costume and even the frames on the window pane were made out of black construction paper, it gave me quite an education. And I should say, if listeners are interested, there's also an article that I wrote about writing ekphrastic poetry, and this piece kind of takes front and center, and that's on my website from the University of Oregon magazine. But it was really like, what was I doing, and did I have permission to do it? Because I didn't study art history. In fact, I think one of the worst grades I got in college was my art history class. So it took a while to feel like I had as much right to view this and to think about this as someone who is a visual artist or an art historian.
So much magic and artifice, huh? Well done.
Thank you.
Should we go on to title poem, I suppose, of your Cloud Pharmacy 2014 publication? We can find that one and hear you read Cloud Pharmacy.
This one, I will say that there's a word that might trip people up, the albastrons. And what it simply is a sort of vessel that would be used by Greeks or Romans, maybe to hold perfume or maybe to hold oils. And just so you know what it is when it comes, it won't trip you up. I think that's the only word.
Right.
Cloud pharmacy. How many apothecary drawers could I fill with these deliberations? The pharmacist's paper cone parsing out a quarter cup of love's resistant drug. Spoons measuring new prescriptions for my uncertainty, heart's way, gesture. Give me cobalt bottles left over from Aunt Iska's cures. Albastrons of ointments, resins to resolve the double helix of desire inside of me. Where is the votive, the vessel, the slide rule calculation of how much good love, alchemically speaking, is good enough? I want spindrift nights on swimmers' thighs. I want an Egyptian elevator inlaid in camphor wood and ivory, a West African drumbeat, an eggnog, a god. I want waves and summer all year long. I want you, and I want more.
I want, I want, I want. Never quite enough for you, is there, Susan? And I found that trio of the drumbeat and the eggnog and God kind of amusing. There's a little wit involved in that one. And the more I thought about it, eggnog is a sort of rhythmic drumbeat that works, but as a trio of, as a phrase, there's some humor involved in that.
I like humor in poems. I think poems work best when there's something that's humorous in it and doesn't take itself too terribly seriously most of the time. It's not always appropriate. I advocate for more humor.
You do like going back to those wonderful objects that you started with of your grandmother's, those vessels, those bottles, the perfumes. I think in Wikipedia you'll find some images of those vessels. Elegant bottles of ceramic, right? Often mm-hmm. ceramic. World to come. This is the final poem of your new collection.
The world to come is a phrase in Judaism that has to do with the afterlife. And from what I can tell, and I'm not a scholar of Judaic law, Judaic history, is there seems to be a little bit of ambivalence about what the world to come includes, because mm-hmm. Unlike Christianity, Judaism is about living your life now and not being focused on the afterlife. And yet there still is a belief in afterlife. And I like the term the world to come. It feels more open and expansive than heaven or hell. So that's where it comes from, the world to come.
Very good.
Let's say we make our own happiness, roll over in the fields, stain our arms and legs with bluegrass. Let's say there's simply 1 year left to draw lists of clouds, slip guilt-free through bars of chocolate, hold each other in this black hole of restlessness, this life. Tonight, we will battle the linoleum squares, laundry stairs, glass deck, where one day the body is sure to grab its last hungry breath. What if all that's left for us is gravity, canned soup, a shimmer of thinning hair? Let's say we make our own happiness even so. The tail swoop of katsura trees, triple shots of strong coffee, a folded map. Then may I remember to thank the Academy of Daily Minutia. Suitcases, car keys, a friend's first novel of karaoke. Who says we can't have it all? The House of Sky and soft catcalls. Who says we can't find another way to fail, to come up short, to catch and release.
That's a great ending there for catch and release. So much that we have is gone, is left behind, is frittered away, but sometimes deliberately let go. Since that's the last one from your book, we're going to go right now to one that you'll find on the website. If you look up, there are two poems listed in Susan Rich's website, poetsusanrich.net.
Susanrich.com.
Okay. Oh, so it's .com. And one of these is one of two poems, What the Maps Won't Tell You.
What the maps won't tell you is how the story ends. If he travels across oceans to rescue himself, herself, like a stubborn harbor master of the heart. The maps don't mention vast underwater volcanoes of lovers or the different archipelagos in the shape of penny candy, the lingering vowels followed by one moan-filled consonant. Would you consider journeying to true north? How might we travel there? Ferry boat or pirate ship, sunfish or float? Do you know the lighthouse is also home to the foghorn? Have you ever thought about how this morning's sound and light show is an improvised soundtrack to keep us safe? Marie Tharp constructed a map of the ocean floor. Although she'd never visited there, no one had, and eventually she drew her dimensions true. Her map told her what hadn't yet occurred. You can draw coordinates out of darkness. You can build a map where one wasn't there before. Sweet poet, you can cross oceans, know a little of what is unknown.
So in this one, what the maps won't tell you before, you are interested in how the maps could inform and how they could inspire. But now you have what's left out, what can't be grasped through something as, well, it's a metaphor anyway. A map is a metaphor.
It is true that Marie Tharp was the first person to draw a map of the ocean floor. And in fact, my first book, The Cartographer's Tongue, has her map of the ocean floor on it. And it's very funny. I've been at book fairs where people have been drawn to my book because they were oceanographers. And they said every oceanography text has that map in it. And that's not my experience. But I think I came to maps wanting to see if they could help me figure things out. And now I'm much more interested in what they leave out. You're absolutely right.
The poem now, Salvage, that's a new one?
No, it's an older one. I think when I was putting together what I'd like to read for today, I was feeling a bit badly for these poems that are a bit orphans, like the one we just looked at, What the Maps Won't Tell You, because it's not yet in a collection. Salvage. She rescues all the torn and broken remnants of the alphabet, the hand-painted illustrations, and offers them new lives. Balancing the accordion folds, she designs a blue horizon from the resistance of their spines and builds book mothers, book houses, book roads. Towers of trashed pages arrive from the front, embedded with blood and hair, or sometimes scarf skin from a finger falls off the giant book egg now on view in the city square. Soon the foreign tourists multiply, rolling their digital boxes to shoot or text, to podcast on the ground to their 5,000 friends. Should they compose a montage or a song? The sculptor, who has known the shock and awe, melts down her small gold leaf and salvages the tired words, like emigrate and breathe. This actually was inspired by a piece of sculpture that was at the Seattle Art Museum at SAM. and the woman sculptor was from Iraq. So this was the Iraq war that this was coming out of.
The sculptor being a book egg too? One of the sculptures?
Yes, building an egg out of books. Everything was done out of these kind of damaged books. Everything was built out of books that had been burnt or ripped or left behind.
Yes. Ah, pretty interesting concept of this artist. Do you remember her name?
I don't. I'm sorry. I should have. Again, this was so before I realized that one should always do that. I've tried to find it, and I haven't had the. I haven't been able to yet.
Let's go and read about what you're tired of.
This poem is called "Tired of Being a Woman," and it does take its inspiration from Pablo Neruda's poem "Tired of Being a Man." Tired of being a woman. As it happens, I am tired of being a woman. Exhausted by the bathroom scale, the carnal ins and outs of who did what to whom. I am tired of rosehip serums that the persistent cat licks off, tired of chamomile face masks, my forehead iridescent as a lacquered carousel horse. I am tired of my country, tired of my feet, of searching for husbands like commuters claim their train cars. One in a dark and empty space, another a little off the rails. Instead, I'd prefer to be a corner store with an echoing bell of welcome. The attainable pleasures, chocolate bars, honeyed challah, yellow tulips in winter. Honestly, I am exhausted from walking home alone, past kneeling lovers, past swans. I don't want to go on paddling towards fascism in the West. I don't want another pizza or to watch the fallen bee stars on New Year's Eve. I can't go on as a pair of eyeglasses. I cruise the local ice cream parlors, the salons, the table linen restaurants that thrust the scent of sirloin and rum onto the sidewalk, that scarf up the mortgage payment, the safety net, the lifetime of save and save and save. All I want is the frisson that comes from an operatic sky, from another stroll at dusk. All I want, my lover's lips on the lower curve of my back. I want the shoreline where sea lions appear and almost wave to me as they warm their flippers in the briny air.
You still want quite a bit in your tiredness, don't you?
Why not? Why not?
I know, the operatic sky is what you... And the lover's lips on the lower curve, why not? All those kneeling lovers and all that, that's in the past. Now you've come to another vision towards the end, and you want to commune with the animal world, the watery world, the watery animal world again. The water, so important in the way that you have taken us overseas and over lands. Susan Rich, it's been a real pleasure to hear your poems, and congratulations on your new publication, Gallery of Postcards and Maps. And once again, I hope the birthday readings will make you happy when you hear them.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the time and the intellect.
You've been listening to Sound Poetry with Susan Rich, and I've been your host, David Gilmore.